Chapter 5. Staring him in the face, he laid a sad case before a celebrated author, beseeching his counsel and assistance. This generous man immediately put aside his own matters, and proceeded to peruse one of the despised manuscripts. Having completed his kindly task, he shook the poor young man cordially by the hand, saying, "I perceive merit in this. Come again to me on Monday." At the time specified, the celebrated author, with a sweet smile, but saying nothing, spread open a magazine which was damp from the press. What was the poor young man's astonishment to discover upon the printed page his own article? "How can I ever," said he, falling upon his knees and bursting into tears, "testify my gratitude for this noble conduct?" The celebrated author was the renowned Snodgrass. The poor young beginner thus rescued from obscurity and starvation was the afterward equally renowned Snagsby. Let this pleasing incident admonish us to turn a charitable ear to all beginners that need help. Sequel. The next week Snagsby was back with 5 rejected manuscripts. The celebrated author was a little surprised, because in the books the young struggler had needed but one lift, apparently. However, he plowed through these papers, removing unnecessary flowers and digging up some acres of adjective stumps, and then succeeded in getting 2 of the articles accepted. A week or so drifted by, and the grateful Snagsby arrived with another cargo. The celebrated author had felt a mighty glow of satisfaction within himself the first time he had successfully befriended the poor young struggler, and had compared himself with the generous people in the books with high gratification. But he was beginning to suspect now that he had struck upon something fresh in the noble episode line. His enthusiasm took a chill. Still, he could not bear to repulse this struggling young author, who clung to him with such pretty simplicity and trustfulness. Well, the upshot of it all was that the celebrated author presently found himself permanently freighted with the poor young beginner. All his mild efforts to unload this cargo went for nothing. He had to give daily counsel, daily encouragement. He had to keep on procuring magazine acceptances, and then revamping the manuscripts to make them presentable. When the young aspirant got a start at last, he rode into sudden fame by describing the celebrated author's private life with such a caustic humor and such minuteness of blistering detail that the book sold a prodigious edition and broke the celebrated author's heart with mortification. With his latest gasp he said, "Alas, the books deceived me, they do not tell the whole story. Beware of the struggling young author, my friends. Whom God sees fit to starve, let not man presumptuously rescue to his own undoing." The grateful husband. One day a lady was driving through the principal street of a great city with her little boy, when the horses took fright and dashed madly away, hurling the coachman from his box, and leaving the occupants of the carnage paralyzed with terror. But a brave youth who was driving a grocery wagon threw himself before the plunging animals, and succeeded in arresting their flight at the peril of his own. This is probably a misprint. The grateful lady took his number, and upon arriving at her home she related the heroic act to her husband, who had read the books, who listened with streaming eyes to the moving recital, and who, after returning thanks, in conjunction with his restored loved ones, to him who suffereth, not even a sparrow, to fall to the ground unnoticed, sent for the brave young person, and, placing a check for $500 in his hand, said, "Take this as a reward for your noble act, William Ferguson, and if ever you shall need a friend, remember that Thompson McSpadden has a grateful heart. Let us learn from this, that a good deed cannot fail to benefit the doer, however humble he may be." Sequel. William Ferguson called the next week and asked Mr. McSpadden to use his influence to get him a higher employment, he feeling capable of better things than driving a grocer's wagon. Mr. McSpadden got him an under clerkship at a good salary. Presently William Ferguson's mother fell sick, and William, well, to cut the story short, Mr. McSpadden consented to take her into his house. Before long she yearned for the society of her younger children. So Mary and Julia were admitted also, and little Jimmy, their brother. Jimmy had a pocket knife, and he wandered into the drawing room with it one day, alone, and reduced $10,000 worth of furniture to an indeterminable value in rather less than 3/4 of an hour. A day or two later he fell downstairs, and broke his neck, and 17 of his family's relatives came to the house to attend the funeral. This made them acquainted, and they kept the kitchen occupied after that, and likewise kept the McSpaddens busy hunting up situations of various sorts for them, and hunting up more when they wore these out. The old woman drank a good deal, and swore a good deal, but the grateful McSpaddens knew it was their duty to reform her, considering what her son had done for them, so they clave nobly to their generous task. William came often, and got decreasing sums of money, and asked for higher and more lucrative employments which the grateful McSpadden more or less promptly procured for him. McSpadden consented also, after some demur, to fit William for college, but when the first vacation came, and the hero requested to be sent to Europe for his health, the persecuted McSpadden rose against the tyrant and revolted. He plainly and squarely refused. William Ferguson's mother was so astounded, that she let her gin bottle drop, and her profane lips refused to do their office. When she recovered she said in a half gasp, "Is this your gratitude? Where would your wife and boy be now, but for my son?" William said, "Is this your gratitude? Did I save your wife's life or not? Tell me that." 7 relations swarmed in from the kitchen and each said, "And this is his gratitude." William's sisters stared, bewildered, and said, "And this is his grat," but were interrupted by their mother, who burst into tears and exclaimed, "To think that my sainted little Jimmy threw away his life in the service of such a reptile." Then the pluck of the revolutionary McSpadden rose to the occasion, and he replied with fervor, "Out of my house, the whole beggarly tribe of you. I was beguiled by the books, but shall never be beguiled again, once is sufficient for me." And turning to William he shouted, "Yes, you did save my wife's life, and the next man that does it shall die in his tracks." Not being a clergyman, I place my text at the end of my sermon instead of at the beginning. Here it is, from Mr. Noah Brooks' Recollections of President Lincoln in Scribner's Monthly. J.H. Hackett, in his part of Falstaff, was an actor who gave Mr. Lincoln great delight. With his usual desire to signify to others his sense of obligation, Mr. Lincoln wrote a genial little note to the actor expressing his pleasure at witnessing his performance. Mr. Hackett, in reply, sent a book of some sort. Perhaps it was one of his own authorship. He also wrote several notes to the president. One night, quite late, when the episode had passed out of my mind, I went to the White House in answer to a message. Passing into the president's office, I noticed, to my surprise, Hackett sitting in the anteroom, as if waiting for an audience. The president asked me if anyone was outside. On being told, he said, half sadly, "Oh, I can't see him, I can't see him, I was in hopes he had gone away." Then he added, "Now this just illustrates the difficulty of having pleasant friends and acquaintances in this place. You know how I liked Hackett as an actor, and how I wrote to tell him so. He sent me that book, and there I thought the matter would end. He is a master of his place in the profession, I suppose, and well fixed in it. But just because we had a little friendly correspondence, such as any two men might have, he wants something. What do you suppose he wants?" I could not guess, and Mr. Lincoln added, "Well, he wants to be consul to London." Oh, dear. I will observe, in conclusion, that the William Ferguson incident occurred, and within my personal knowledge, though I have changed the nature of the details, to keep William from recognizing himself in it. All the readers of this article have in some sweet and gushing hour of their lives played the role of magnanimous incident hero. I wish I knew how many there are among them who are willing to talk about that episode, and like to be reminded of the consequences that flowed from it. Punch, brothers, punch. Will the reader please to cast his eye over the following lines, and see if he can discover anything harmful in them? Conductor, when you receive a fare, punch in the presence of the passenger. A blue trip slip for an 8-cent fare, a buff trip slip for a 6-cent fare, a pink trip slip for a 3-cent fare, punch in the presence of the passenger. Chorus, punch, brothers. Punch with care. Punch in the presence of the passenger. I came across these jingling rhymes in a newspaper a little while ago, and read them a couple of times. They took instant and entire possession of me. All through breakfast they went waltzing through my brain, and when, at last, I rolled up my napkin, I could not tell whether I had eaten anything or not. I had carefully laid out my day's work the day before, thrilling tragedy in the novel which I am writing. I went to my den to begin my deed of blood. I took up my pen, but all I could get it to say was, punch in the presence of the passenger. I fought hard for an hour, but it was useless. My head kept humming, a blue trip slip for an 8-cent fare, a buff trip slip for a 6-cent fare, and so on, without peace or respite. The day's work was ruined, I could see that plainly enough. I gave up and drifted downtown, and presently discovered that my feet were keeping time to that relentless jingle. When I could stand it no longer, I altered my step. But it did no good. Those rhymes accommodated themselves to the new step, and went on harassing me just as before. I returned home, and suffered all the afternoon, suffered all through an unconscious and unrefreshing dinner, suffered, and cried, and jingled all through the evening, went to bed and rolled, tossed, and jingled right along, the same as ever, got up at midnight frantic, and tried to read. But there was nothing visible upon the whirling page except punch. Punch in the presence of the passenger. By sunrise I was out of my mind, and everybody marveled, and was distressed at the idiotic burden of my ravings. Punch, oh, punch. Punch in the presence of the passenger. 2 days later, on Saturday morning, I arose, a tottering wreck, and went forth to fulfill an engagement with a valued friend, the Rev. Mister, to walk to the Talcott Tower, 10 miles distant. He stared at me, but asked no questions. We started. Mister talked as is his wont. I said nothing, I heard nothing. At the end of a mile, Mister said, "Ark, are you sick?" I never saw a man look so haggard, and worn and absent-minded. "Say something, do." Drearily, without enthusiasm, I said, "Colon punch, brothers, punch with care, punch in the presence of the passenger." My friend eyed me blankly, looked perplexed. They said, "I do not think I get your drift, Mark. Then does not seem to be any relevancy in what you have said, certainly nothing sad. And yet maybe it was the way you said the words. I never heard anything that sounded so pathetic. What is, but I heard no more. I was already far away with my pitiless, heartbreaking blue trip slip for an 8-cent fare, buff trip slip for a 6-cent fare, pink trip slip for a 3-cent fare, punch in the presence of the passenger. I do not know what occurred during the other 9 miles. However, all of a sudden Mister laid his hand on my shoulder and shouted, "Oh, wake up! Wake up! Wake up! Don't sleep all day. Here we are at the tower, man. I have talked myself deaf and dumb and blind, and never got a response. Just look at this magnificent autumn landscape. Look at it. Look at it. Feast your eye on it. You have traveled. You have seen boaster landscapes elsewhere. Come, now, deliver an honest opinion. What do you say to this?" I sighed wearily, and murmured, "A buff trip slip for a 6-cent fare, a pink trip slip for a 3-cent fare, punch in the presence of the passenger." Rev. Mister stood there, very grave, full of concern, apparently, and looked long at me. Then he said, Mark, there is something about this that I cannot understand. Those are about the same words you said before. There does not seem to be anything in them, and yet they nearly break my heart when you say them. Punch in the how is it they go? I began at the beginning, and repeated all the lines. My friend's face lighted with interest. He said, "Why, what a captivating jingle it is. It is almost music. It flows along so nicely. I have nearly caught the rhymes myself. Say them over just once more, and then I'll have them, sure." I said them over. Then Mr. said them. He made one little mistake, which I corrected. The next time and the next he got them right. Now a great burden seemed to tumble from my shoulders. That torturing jingle departed out of my brain, and a grateful sense of rest and peace descended upon me. I was light-hearted enough to sing, and I did sing for half an hour, straight along, as we went jogging homeward. Then my freed tongue found blessed speech again, and the pent talk of many a weary hour began to gush and flow. It flowed on and on, joyously, jubilantly, until the fountain was empty and dry. As I wrung my friend's hand at parting, I said, "Haven't we had a royal good time? But now I remember, you haven't said a word for 2 hours. Come, come, out with something." The Rev. Mr. turned a lackluster eye upon me, drew a deep sigh, and said, without animation, without apparent consciousness, "Punch, brothers, punch with care. Punch in the presence of the passenger." A pang shot through me as I said to myself, "Poor fellow, poor fellow. He has got it now." I did not see Mr. for 2 or 3 days after that. Then, on Tuesday evening, he staggered into my presence and sank dejectedly into a seat. He was pale, worn. He was a wreck. He lifted his faded eyes to my face and said, "Ah, Mark, it was a ruinous investment that I made in those heartless rhymes. They have ridden me like a nightmare, day and night, hour after hour, to this very moment. Since I saw you, I have suffered the torments of the lost. Saturday evening I had a sudden call, by telegraph, and took the night train for Boston. The occasion was the death of a valued old friend who had requested that I should preach his funeral sermon. I took my seat in the cars, and set myself to framing the discourse. But I never got beyond the opening paragraph, for then the train started and the car wheels began their clack, 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 apostrophe, apostrophe, and right away those odious rhymes fitted themselves to that accompaniment. For an hour I sat there, and said a syllable of those rhymes to every separate and distinct clack, the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.